This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Catch up with Senators Duckworth and Durbin during the August congressional recess. Illinois elected representatives are buzzing around the state.
Nazis are not on the side of this country. You truly love this country, you cannot reject the very basic values that are enshrined in the Constitution.
Charlie Schlinker has the interviews with reaction to the latest Trump administration controversy, plus questions about health care and agriculture. GLT's Ryan Denham catches up with McLean County Trump supporters we first heard from during the election season. Find out if their support is decreasing. And get an update on Bloomington's roads and streets and efforts to repair and maintain them. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's August 17th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's been a tough week for President Donald Trump after his controversial comments on the violence in Charlottesville. That backlash spread to McLean County, where the local Republican Party faced criticism for siding with Trump's "both sides are to blame" remarks. So how are Trump's problems playing here in McLean County, especially with those who voted for him in November? GLT's Ryan Denham checks back in with some local Republicans.
Last November, after President Trump was elected, I interviewed a few Republicans from rural McLean County to see why they supported him. Why did he win some of these rural areas just outside our more liberal college town by such wide margins, in some places with 70% of the vote or more? That's the only reason he narrowly won McLean County as a whole, even as Hillary Clinton won Bloomington Normal. One of the Republicans I spoke to back then was Brian Taylor, who is the GOP precinct committeeman for rural Cropsey Township. Trump won 77% of the voters in Taylor's area. Back then, Taylor was a little bit on the fence about Trump. He voted for him, but he wasn't crazy about him. So when I called Taylor again this week to ask if he's even more conflicted about Trump, given all that's happened, I was expecting him to say, yes, he was disappointed in Trump. But he's not.
I'm very happy with it. I know that when I first talked to you, I was kind of on the fence because I didn't support him necessarily in the primary, but I, you know, obviously voted for him in the general. With everything going on, there were a few things that had me a little bit concerned, but overall, I think he's doing a very good job right now.
What's one of his accomplishments that you're been most happy with?
Well, I think that right now he's kind of sticking to his guns with what he's promised in the, you know, in the primaries and in the leading up to the election. He's trying to get his agenda pushed through. I mean, granted, he's not having much success. I lay a lot of that, you know, blame at the feet of Congress, but he is trying, in my opinion anyway, and it seems like he's doing what he said he was going to do, or he's trying to anyway.
So what's something that he's done that's maybe disappointed you in some way?
I'm still a little disappointed with some of his tweets. You know, that's one of the things that kind of bothered me the most about him was it just seemed a little unnecessary and maybe possibly better ways of going about doing it. But, you know, it's a minor thing in the overall big picture. I think overall everything that he's trying to accomplish seems to pretty much fit the bill with what I was hoping he would do.
While some Republicans are still largely staying by Trump's side, recent controversies have chipped away at his support. Trump's approval rating in Gallup daily tracking was at an all-time low last week at just 36%. Our last Republican president, George W. Bush, was at 56%. That's 20 points higher at this point in his first term. Trump's support is even waning among Republicans nationally. His 79% approval rating among Republicans is high, but that's the lowest it's been since taking office. And all of that low approval was measured before his widely condemned "both sides" remarks this week about Charlottesville. Republican Governor Bruce Rauner does not often mention Trump by name, but yesterday he used some of his strongest language yet against Trump. He was asked about Trump's remarks on Charlottesville.
I vehemently disagree with the president's comments about the tragedy in Charlottesville. I vehemently disagree with the president's comments.
Jim Soldner from Ellsworth is a Republican and vice chair of the McLean County Board. He was a Trump supporter initially and liked some of his early moves on immigration and border security. But as time has gone on, 200-plus days into Trump's administration, Soldner is off the Trump train. After Charlottesville, he's out.
No. I mean, my answer is no. I wouldn't vote for him again. Now, I don't know that I would vote for Hillary or whether I would vote for independent. I don't know who I would vote for. But for what he showed me this past 200 days, I can't support him, nor would I vote for him.
Soldner is in a bind. He's a Republican, and he's running for re-election for the county board next year. And he'll face a Democratic challenger, David Siebert from Saybrook. Soldner is worried about the effect Trump is having on the Republican brand, and a recent controversial Facebook post by the McLean County Republican Party that supported Trump's remarks.
I realize I'm going to lose some votes to people that just don't like Republicans because they associate President Trump with that. And so, again, I realize I'm going to probably lose some votes with that. My concern now is that with some statements that have been made here locally, that I'm afraid some people out there, some voters are going to associate me with what maybe our local party's leaders have said, and that concerns me also. So I am concerned right now. And again, I want to make perfectly clear that I don't support what these people, the white, separatists and the KKK and the Nazis. I don't support any of that, what they did in Charlottesville.
Retired farmer Daryl Yoder lives near McLean, where he's the Republican precinct committeeman for Mount Hope Township. Trump won that precinct with 76% of the vote. Mount Hope is a heavily rural area, a bedroom community for most people who work in Springfield, Bloomington, or Lincoln. Yoder says that Trump has been controversial, to say the least.
The worst of it is he hasn't really accomplished a lot. But he has indeed brought up a lot of controversial income tax reform, the wall, and this Obamacare thing. And now he's faced with North Korea and several other foreign aspects that I think he thrived as a businessman, but I'm not sure he's going to be able to handle it politically. But he keeps trying to find personnel to help him on that, which to me is a sign of a good manager.
Yoder has been disappointed at times with Trump's strangely political remarks at a Boy Scouts event, that infamous Access Hollywood groping comments tape. Mostly, Yoder thinks Trump needs a better team of people around him.
You can tell he's been a businessman. I think he expected all the Republicans that he had hired them. They were working for him now. And the fact that they weren't hired by him, they were elected by their own constituency. A little bit tough for him to follow.
Brandon Heppner lives east of Lexington in tiny Lawndale Township, population 158. He's the Republican precinct committeeman out there, and Trump won big at Lawndale's polling place in Emmanuel Lutheran Church. Heppner is also on the McLean County Republican Party's executive committee, making him one of the top leaders locally.
I really am just very pleased. Since I am in outside sales, I call on a lot of different types of businesses, and there's a lot of optimism out there. One of my restaurant customers back in February was saying Januarys are usually slow, but I'm still waiting for that. There's a lot of coal mining families now, for instance, that are having a regular job that didn't before. There's, you know, just an economic uptick has occurred, even in McLean County. And so this is, you know, what we need.
Heppner says that Trump's number one accomplishment is the appointment of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. He's a little bummed about Trump backing a less conservative candidate for a special election in Georgia, but that's about it.
Not so much him, but I think the party leadership is where the real disappointment is. The chance to overturn the Obamacare on both houses just hasn't come up. I mean, there's a lot of other accomplishments that are occurring, but since those are such big issues, that and the tax reform, it's kind of overshadowing any other things that have happened.
So as criticism in some corners grows, here in McLean County, many of Trump's allies are still his allies. Brian Taylor from rural Cropsey Township summed it up best when I asked him to size up the Russia investigation. Is he worried? Is it overblown?
I think it's been completely overblown. And quite honestly, it does concern me. It concerns me that the way I see it is, I think of myself as a fairly moderate, person. And when I see the constant media narrative and the constant media story that over and over and over again, quite honestly, it really turns me off to the media in general. It makes me not trust them as much.
Reporting as a member of that media, I'm Ryan Denham.
Find more coverage of local politics, including early announcements about the 2018 elections, at our website, WGLT.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up, get an update on the condition of Bloomington's roads and streets and the efforts and obstacles to maintain and repair them. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's the August congressional recess. Most people are focused on winding up the summer, starting school for the kids, or ramping up a project at work. It is high political season for area elected representatives heading back to districts, pressing flesh at the state fair, tending old relationships, and starting new ones, especially among constituencies not always friendly to one party or another. That was Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth's purpose in dropping by the Illinois Farm Bureau. Ag interests have not always had an easy fit with Democrats. For instance, the much-reviled Waters Rule for the EPA was an Obama administration creation. GLT's Charlie Schlinker was along with other reporters talking with Duckworth as she emphasized her ties to ag and her recognition of the importance of the industry to the state.
I did not grow up on a farm, but I lived in DeKalb for many, many years. And my first job in Illinois over 27 years ago was with the American Farmland Trust. So I am fairly familiar with agricultural issues. And it was really funny because as a congresswoman, I represented a small suburb of Chicago. And when I started talking with folks in the ag community, I said, listen, you know, and I started talking about a lot of farm issues and crop insurance. Like, how do you know all this? I said, well, because I used to work for the American Farmland Trust. And I get it. I've detasseled corn along with if you live in DeKalb, you have to detassel corn at some point in time. And we were able to really establish a great working relationship. And now that I am in the Senate, it's really important to have folks that I can turn to and say, look, we're working on issues that has to do with locks and dams on the Mississippi. We are working on issues that have to do with WERDA or issues that have to do with making sure that we provide the services to our agricultural community, the same level of service that we give to Chicago or large metropolitan areas. And so to have this partnership has been really important.
NAFTA has just begun a renegotiating period. Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue came to Central Illinois last week. What are you hearing from ag today about their key issues?
Well, I'm really pleased that Secretary Perdue came through Illinois and stopped in Illinois on his tour. And in fact, I voted for him. I was one of the Democrats who voted to confirm him. I think that he really understands, especially corn and soybean, which is really important for us. And so I was very pleased that he came through and it can be a partner. But that said, the Department of Agriculture's budget is significantly cut under the budget that President Trump put forward. And I'm going back to Washington at the end of August, and we're going to go right into that budget talk. And I'm going to work as hard as I can to put more money into the Department of Agriculture. Programs that are cut in it include everything from support to innovative programs for younger farmers to protecting safe drinking water in rural communities. And so the cut to the ag budget is really significant for agricultural communities. As far as trade is concerned, you know, my focus will be to make sure that we protect trade and not allow agriculture to get caught up in the fights that happen when it comes to the manufacturing sector. That's the problem that happened with TPP, for example. TPP failed largely because a lot of the failures within the manufacturing side comes with Chinese-made products. It had nothing to do with agriculture, as an example, in terms of the difficulties it ran into. So my job will be to make sure that my colleagues understand how vital and important agriculture is and to continue to defend and stand up for those ag interests, because we are the greatest agricultural producer in the world. We are the gold standard. People in China want to buy food grown in the United States. They trust the food grown here more than they trust the food grown in China. And we need to make sure that we maintain that edge.
Farmers are particularly wincing about the cuts to crop insurance as well. Is there a middle ground on that issue?
No, I refuse to start from the cuts. There's this idea that, the Trump administration is coming with such a huge cut to allow us to negotiate to somewhere in the middle. I refuse to let the starting point for negotiations be that massive cut. We need to start from where crop insurance was currently, where it is currently, and have the conversation there. I will advocate very strongly for crop insurance. The problem that we have is that a lot of people who, folks who live in New York and in large metropolitan areas and represent those areas don't understand what crop insurance is. I hear from my colleagues often where they call it a handout. They call it a freebie. And when I tell them, no, actually, farmers have to buy crop insurance. It's a decision they make at the beginning of the year in order to make sure they protect themselves. And people don't even realize that. And so I'm not going to let folks who don't understand crop insurance start the negotiations from a negative. We start from where we are, and we'll negotiate from there. And you won't find a stronger supporter for crop insurance than me.
If you had your druthers, what do you hope will emerge from the NAFTA talks?
We need to protect ag, while we also need to look at things that, places where things didn't exist during NAFTA, like cyber, the cyber marketplace, all of those things we need to look at as well. But we need to always protect ag.
The Republican McLean County Party Chair has doubled down on President Trump's remarks on the equivalency issue regarding Charlottesville. Would you respond to that line of thought?
I reject it. If you stand with Nazis and you stand with racists, then you are not a fine person. Then you are not a patriot, and you are not someone who truly loves this country. Because it goes against the very values that founded our nation. I reject racism. I reject white nationalists. I reject Nazis. There's no room for that. I always start my conversations with folks assuming that they love this country as much as I do, and we negotiate and we work there and try to find common ground. But if you are someone who is a Nazi, you do not truly love this country, because you can't truly love America and at the same time be a Nazi or be a racist.
Well, is it fair to add in the anti-fascist groups on the left or the guy who shot congressman during the baseball practice recently?
I think what we see here is attempts by fascists and Nazis to muddy the waters, to take away their responsibility for what happened in Charlotte. We're talking about people who showed up with helmets and loaded weapons and went out there and conducted themselves in the name of Nazism. Look, I served in Iraq, attached to the 3rd Division. And this is a division that fought during the Battle of the Bulge to rescue the 101st Airborne Division. I have family members who have fought for this country going back to the Revolution, who fought on both sides during the Civil War. But I know exactly who is on the side of America and who is not. And Nazis and white supremacists are not on the side of this country. You truly love this country, you cannot reject the very basic values that are enshrined in the Constitution of the United States. It's that simple.
That's U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth speaking to reporters, including GLT's Charlie Schlenker at the Illinois Farm Bureau in Bloomington. It's Sound Ideas. The August recess is also a time for ambitious politicians looking to expand their name recognition for a run for higher office. So it is with Democratic rising star Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy. He stopped in Normal yesterday evening for the annual McLean County Democratic Baldini Dinner. Krishnamoorthy spoke with GLT student reporter Bailey Steelman about the need for the federal government to raise the debt ceiling.
Well, I think that, first of all, it's really important that we pay our bills as a country. I think that it's very important that our money and our currency has the power that goes along with being the U.S. dollar. And part of that means people have to have full faith and credit in our currency. And so we have to raise the debt ceiling in order to pay the bills. And I hope that folks on both sides of the aisle understand that concept. And I think that a lot of Democratic votes will probably be needed to deliver this particular vote. In return, I hope that everyone is responsible with the federal budget and spending.
How easy will it be to agree?
Let's see. You've seen what's happened with healthcare. Unfortunately, we weren't able to come to terms on much-needed reforms to improve the healthcare system. If one side decides that they're going to do it entirely in a partisan fashion, then it will be very difficult to come to terms. But if they decide that it's time to compromise and basically try to bargain a proper solution to this problem, I think we'll come to terms.
What is the way forward with North Korea?
Well, first of all, I think that we have to tone down the rhetoric, and I hope that everyone stops tweeting about North Korea. Secondly, I think that we have to use regional diplomacy to resolve this problem peacefully. That means, working with the Chinese, who have tremendous leverage with the North Koreans, to basically get the North Koreans to de-escalate. And then third, we do have to, defend ourselves and make sure that our allies are also defended in a responsible manner. I do believe in missile defense systems that can potentially thwart a launch of missiles against countries in the neighborhood and potentially the United States.
What should the administration be doing to get there and nuancing its diplomatic efforts then?
I think that it's really important with regard to diplomatic efforts that we're very clear about what the outcome should be. I don't think that we should be threatening war. I don't think we should be engaging in bluster. I think we should take a page out of the playbook that John F. Kennedy used during the Cuban Missile Crisis, where he used tough but creative diplomacy to basically resolve that very, very dire situation in a peaceful manner. I think right now Donald Trump and the administration must tone down the rhetoric right away. And as I said before, work with the Chinese, work with our South Korean and Japanese allies to come up with a good resolution.
Is there anything else that I should know?
Well, I think that after the events of Charlottesville, I think that everyone should know that there is no place for hate in America. Furthermore, there is no equivalence between hate preachers and those who would oppose them. Edmund Burke once said that all that's necessary for the triumph of evil is for good people to do nothing. And so that is the test that the public and Americans need to meet. We have to do something to get at the root of what's going on in the rise of bigotry and hatred, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, etc., and then put a stop to it. That's why I've called for a hate crimes commission, a bipartisan, independent hate crimes commission to be created to get to the root of what's going on here, because we can't afford to allow any room for hatred to exist in America.
Illinois U.S. Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy. He represents the 8th District in the northwest suburbs of Chicago, and he spoke with GLT student reporter Bailey Steelman. I'm Mike McCurdy at Sound Ideas for U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, the minority whip, the highest-ranking Illinois Democrat, and a man in office for decades. There aren't a lot of new constituencies to cultivate. Durbin is spending his time focusing on rallying the troops over health care. He visited Chestnut Health Systems in Bloomington to promote community health centers and the Affordable Care Act. GLT's Charlie Schlenker was at a Durbin news conference where the senator addressed the question of whether the effort by Democratic Senator Patty Murray and Republican Lamar Alexander to revive a health reform bill will happen in an open fashion. Efforts at change haven't been notable for openness so far.
When the Republican-controlled Congress tried to do this on their own, no help from any Democrats, they passed the bill in the House of Representatives by 4 votes. If 2 members of the House had voted the other way, it would have failed. Then it came to the Senate, and it didn't pass. They tried 3 different versions. They all failed. They couldn't get the Republicans to vote for them. So at that point, this single-party, take-it-or-leave-it approach ended. And then they started the conversation about the traditional, regular order. Take it through the committee. Democrats and Republicans work on amendments together. That, to me, is promising. But we've wasted 7 months. We should have been doing this all along. I trust Lamar Alexander, Republican of Tennessee, and Patty Murray, a Democrat of Washington, to come up with good alternatives. I'm sure that they'll be part of their suggestion that I don't like at all. That's the nature of compromise in the legislative world. But if at the end of the day, we don't take away health insurance coverage, but protect what we have and try to expand it, if at the end of the day, we make sure that health insurance is still something that's within the grasp of a family with someone with a pre-existing condition, if at the end of the day, we have built into the system a way to protect Medicaid and its future needs, then I'm on board. I want to be part of it.
What do you think of some of the trade-offs might be for Democrats and Republicans?
Well, they keep talking about giving the states more flexibility. Watch out for that word flexibility. It usually means less money. And even Governor Rauner, Republican governor of our state, wrote to the members of the delegation, congressional delegation, and opposed the Republican plans, saying that it would cost Illinois billions of dollars in Medicaid reimbursement. I worry about this so-called flexibility. I just don't think it's there. If we don't do something proactively, medical care inflation goes up faster than regular inflation. If we do something aggressively to reward quality outcomes and keep costs under control, we can slow it down. That's the best we can do. And I worry that if you give a fixed amount to a state or a limited amount to a state and medical inflation takes off, fewer people have protection.
The deal killer on the Republican side appears to be the individual mandate. What do Democrats have to offer to the GOP to still get the numbers and roll to support the overall system of insurance?
That is a key to it. And what it boils down to is what I mentioned earlier, the individual health insurance marketplace. Who ends up in that marketplace? People whose income, who don't have health insurance through their employer, although most of us do, most Americans do. They don't have health insurance through their employer, and they're not wealthy enough to pay anything that's charged, and they're not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid. So they end up in this insurance marketplace, looking at the silver, gold plans and all the options that are out there, and they try to pick one that they can afford. The costs keep going up because the first people who jump to get in line there are older and sicker. They're the ones who say, I need this. The premium may be high, the alternative is unacceptable. No care or care that bankrupts me. So you have a pool, 6% of Americans in the individual marketplace that is filled initially with older, sicker people. Now, if insurance is going to work, you also have to bring into this insurance pool younger, healthier people who aren't going to turn in a lot of claims. Now we find ourselves in a position where there aren't enough of them. So the health insurance premiums, the scary stories you hear, are about people older, sicker, paying these in premiums. So what are we going to do about it? You know, Massachusetts came up with a way. They said, we're going to pick a number. And if you don't buy insurance in Massachusetts, you're going to pay that number. In other words, you are required as an individual to buy health insurance in Massachusetts or you're going to face a penalty. It worked. Over 95% of people in Massachusetts signed up. We tried to find that number at the federal level, and we're still looking for it. I don't think we've come up with a good number yet that would be a penalty on your income tax if you didn't buy health insurance. But that is the stick that might bring people into it. The alternative that's been kicked around is, what if we just take this group, the 6%, and said, we're going to treat you differently. We're going to give you basic Medicare Plus, Medicare Advantage programs, insurance policies that are available, and we may have to subsidize it. But we're going to take care of that that group. The employer mandate is another one that is tough. And most employers provide health insurance, but many do not, and they argue it's too expensive. I hear this a lot from restaurants and hotels, and they say our people are younger, healthier, don't want health insurance, would rather have a pay raise. So we're not going to provide them health insurance unless you tell us we have to. And if we do, we'll cut their wages. That's a tough trade-off on the situation. But between, you know, the individual and employer mandate, I think we can move to a point where the number of people uninsured in this country is getting smaller and smaller each year. I haven't given up on it, and I think it's worth the effort.
The original attraction of employer-offered plans was to compete in the marketplace for scarce workers. With the retirement of the baby boomers and changing demographics, will the country have enough of a labor shortage to make employer plans popular again?
It might, except for one thing. More and more older folks, Medicare-eligible folks, are still working. And you talk to fast food restaurants, and many people in their workforce are older employees. They're not well off enough under Social Security. They've worked all their lives and still feel pretty good and physically fit, healthy to do it. And in fairness to them, a lot of these restaurant people tell me they're darn good employees. They've been working their whole lives. They know you're supposed to show up and be dressed for the job and ready to perform. So I put that qualifier on it. I just don't think that the baby boomers are vacating the job market in the numbers that were expected.
What sort of time frame do you hope for Senator Murray and Senator Alexander to come up with a legislative product that can be disseminated to the wider Senate and the House?
Well, this is a word you don't associate with the Senate very often, but fast. They have to, because the premium subsidy that the federal government gives to health insurance companies is in danger. If we don't pay it, the health insurance companies have told us they're going to raise premiums through the roof. So we've got to come up with an alternative and fast. And that means before the end of the year, which by Senate standards is historic.
Well, can it happen with the GOP pivoting toward tax reform?
It can in this regard. I believe that the congressional Republicans who voted for the plan that cleared the House of Representatives had no idea what they were getting into. They thought the Senate would save them. They thought the Senate would come back with something more moderate. Well, we haven't been able to with the way we've approached it so far. And many of these Republican members of the House of Representatives have come home to Illinois, all seven of them voted for it, and found out that their vote was opposed by every major medical advocacy group in our state. The hospitals, the doctors, the nurses, the pediatricians, the surgeons, the community health care clinics, all opposed it. So I think they're pretty anxious to right this wrong and to make up for a bad vote.
U.S. Senator Dick Durbin speaking with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Durbin said if President Trump stops making support payments to insurance companies, premiums will spike by 20% and 1 million Americans will lose coverage next year. He also says a recent study showed that Illinois community health centers like the one Chestnut operates saves 27% in total spending per Medicaid patient compared to non-health center providers. That's because the various care needs are integrated in an overall patient plan. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. How many times do we have to say it? Yeah, our first ever bocce ball tournament is going to be fun. 32 two-person teams and a double elimination bracket, food trucks, beverages from Stave, and it all takes place on the grounds of Normandy Village in Normal. The excitement's building, right? Go to WGLT.org to learn more and sign up for the first ever GLT Bocce at the Village. We're excited. You excited?
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. Auto repair shops in Bloomington Normal have likely seen an increase in business because of the condition of streets, especially in Bloomington, where Public Works Director Jim Karch has been taking a look at a new spending plan and new approaches to plug up a problem that has been decades in the making. Correspondent Colleen Reynolds has more in this first of a two-part Sound Ideas interview.
The city of Bloomington spent a record $10 million in 2014. That was the big year to resurface and pave some streets. It was all part of an acknowledgement and discussion that went on with the city council at the time about the lack of keeping up with street maintenance. And of course, that was because of a lot of budget pressures. You know, we had the recession and trying to catch up from that, plus pension pressures. And so that all kind of contributed to the city maybe not spending as much per year as it should have been. So 2014 was a catch-up year. We're talking today with Bloomington Public Works Director Jim Karch. And Jim, I'm going to quote you off of the city website, is saying, even though $10 million sounds like a lot of money, you say the city would have to spend $9 million a year just to bring all the streets to a minimum rating of 4 on a 1 to 10 scale, with 10 being the best. So we know in 2015, city spent spent about $2 million on resurfacing. And so in short, we know the city is still way behind in what it's spending and what it can do. I'm going to give you just a few more stats. And even though people talk about the condition of our streets, and we all know that especially in some areas, they're not what they should be, I think it's interesting to just look at the stats from June. Potholes, 77. Water ditches, 19. What is that?
And water ditches are whenever our water department goes in, makes a repair, our crews come back and do the final surface repair. So it could be asphalt or concrete.
Okay.
But it's still a problem with the pavement.
Cave-ins, mm-hmm. 6. Concrete street panels, 2. Contractor ditches, 2. And then hot asphalt, 19 locations. That's 36,000, almost 37,000 square feet. That is a lot. And you're talking about just really repairs.
This is just for repairs. This isn't even our larger asphalt program.
Wow. So people know the streets are bad. I just thought those stats were kind of revealing. And so the question to you, Jim, is this strictly a money issue, or is it also an availability of hot mix and crews to do the work?
Well, really, the answer is the problem with the streets is both a money issue and a capacity issue with what kind of asphalt we can have available. So, yes, there is a lack of resources to be able to do all that we need. But even if we could have, let's say we were given a blank check for resurfacing on an annual basis, there's a certain capacity the local contractors, they hit a limit, and it becomes harder for them to be able to get enough asphalt locally to be able to really address what we need. So what we are talking about is this has been a long-term problem in the city of Bloomington. Where we are at currently with our streets didn't just get here this year. When I started the city of Bloomington in 2000, and whenever I started, really back then, we had hardly any resurfacing program at all. In fact, I think the year I started in 2000, there was no money put toward resurfacing. And then after that, it was $500,000 to $1 million, anywhere in there for a number of years. I was the engineer that put together those contracts for a while. And so whenever I became a director in 2008, one of the first things that really hit the radar was trying to be systematic in how we deal with our infrastructure issues. You know, everybody can say, yes, oh, the roads are bad, but how do you determine which comes first? How do you actually give an objective, professional recommendation to our elected officials to say, if you want this service level, here's how much money you should spend? And so because of that, we started, and I give full credit to our staff, they really took ownership of this concept of stewardship. They rated every street in town. A citizen can go out on our website and see what their street is rated, a 1 to 10 system. It's a nationally accepted system. We plug all of that into the Excel machine that churns out a number and allows us to say that, like you said, it would take $9 million on an annual basis to be able to bring our streets up to that 4 condition. And 4 is really where you stop seeing the potholes. And really, the potholes are nothing more than a symptom of a larger problem. That's all they are. I mean, so what we're trying to do is, what level can we really get to as a community where it's not potholes that people are worried about? You know, the quality of the infrastructure matters heartfully to our citizens. We heard that in the last election. We've heard that consistently over the past few years. And so I give, again, credit to our elected officials that they've taken that data, they've taken that objective data, and they did increase since 2009. They did increase the budget for our street resurfacing within the parameters of what they felt they could do, but it was increased from what it had been in the past. But what we as a staff have said is, you could double it. You could double it. Right now, we're spending about just under $4 million a year, and our current recommendation is double it to $8 million consistent dollars a year. And then what that would allow is, over a 10-year period, it would allow us to get to a level of 5, a service level of 5, which is above that bare minimum for our arterial streets, the streets that, you know, you have 10,000 vehicles on a day. The majority of where cars travel they're in good condition. People feel good about it. On the collectors, they'd be a 4. So you don't see the potholes, but they're starting to develop. But the residentials, we'd have to say they are a 3. to where maybe in front of your house, where there's only a couple hundred cars, there can be a pothole or two. You're traveling slower. We can't make this town perfect overnight. We've got to start, you know, turning the tide. And so we have to understand it's going to take some time to turn it around.
So that's the money side.
Mm-hmm.
That's your recommendation to city leaders. But there is that availability side.
That's true.
Of hot mix, of asphalt.
That's true.
So can you describe, I know this is not very sexy for people, but
pretty boring topic, but people do care about
roads.
But
they really do
care.
So maybe just as briefly as you can, explain sort of the supply and demand problem and how that factors in to what you're going to be able to do.
Sure. So local contractors, we have one large local contractor, and they do the majority of the interstate work. They do the majority in this community. There's a smaller asphalt contractor, both of them do a very good job. It's just more of an issue of what do they have the capacity to do.
So you're talking about Roe Construction is the big one.
Roe Construction, McLean UCM,
County,
yep, United
McLean
Contractors,
County Asphalt,
Midwest, and McLean County
does
Asphalt.
The smaller, more, you know, commercial parking lots, that kind of thing. Okay.
And so the city has tried to even break up our asphalt contracts to get more competition, quite honestly. We want to get the best price we can for our citizens, the best stewardship we can. But McLean County Asphalt, they haven't been bidding the last couple of years. And the vendor from Pontiac, Epple, they haven't been bidding as well on some of these local contracts. And so there is a capacity issue. And so that's why staff has modified our recommendation to kind of that $8 million number. We said, what can we, with the objective criteria, we know, what could we accomplish in the next 10 years if we had $8 million a year? And so that's where that, if that's the capacity the local contracting community has in that range. I mean, you say $8 million, but it depends overall on the price, but that's the range it's in.
So there's also another factor that could be influencing an Epple from not bidding, and that is that local contractors are given an advantage. Do you think it would be worth the city council considering waiving that when you have a limited supply contractor or, you know, a limited availability contractor?
Sure. The current policy doesn't allow it, but, you know, staff definitely would see benefit in something like this where there is, you know, there is concern. It's tough because there's positives, some really great positives with the local preference policy. But there's times it has an impact. And so, yes, we've been told that we're not getting bids from, you know, Pontiac because, you know, that local preference policy they've put in writing, it's been a detriment to them. And so those are the tough policy issues that a governing body has to consider.
So I want to turn the clock back a little bit again and talk about early on in your tenure at the city, and I don't know what point it was, but there was a point in which you actually were pretty high on the idea of, hey, you know, the city does garbage collection, which a lot of other cities contract that out. The city handles water, which a lot of municipalities contract out. Why don't we reverse that? Why don't we, since we're good at doing service and we're good at managing big public service, why don't we consider owning and operating our own asphalt plant? And over time, wouldn't we save money and be able to do more for our citizens? So take me back to that time frame and what kind of work you put into that thought process and how it was received.
Boy, it's been a few years, but I probably would say back in 2009, we were looking at that. I'm not a big fan of just doing things the way you've always done them. If you know there's a problem, if we have a problem with hot asphalt in some way or pricing, let's look outside of the box. Why not? Who else is doing that? Are there things that really keep us from doing that? And so, we really did. We looked at what are the upfront capital costs? What would it take? Who else is doing it? Can we go see what they're doing? Is it working? So we actually spent some time even in 2009, then even over the years, as of a couple years ago, revisited again. Kevin Burke is a person I've worked with. He used to be with the Illinois Department of Transportation, and he transitioned in his retirement over to the Illinois Asphalt Paving, the statewide organization. And he was a great resource. He really was a great resource for us, the city. And it really helped us to see that at this time, that wasn't the right path to go down. We couldn't find a mechanism. There were issues such as that initial upfront capital cost, of course, for the larger asphalt plant. We're actually still, I'm still interested in new technology as they get smaller asphalt plants. That's one of the things that when you look at some of those smaller asphalt plants, they can maybe overcome some of the environmental hurdles, some of the permitted issues, because that's the other side of it. Places like Rockford, that have looked at doing this. There can be environmental issues, smell, perceived issues with carcinogens. Let's be realistic. People in the community, that can be a problem. If you site a new asphalt plant, that can really stir up some concern. And so we have to make sure that's worth it as well. So those are definitely considerations that I will never say something's off the table. But as of right now, the only people we could find, Henry County, they were looking at it. Some places in Florida do it. But again, it really is an economies of scale. You had to have enough suppliers that, you know, enough people that were end users, really, that it became worth it. And so, you know, do we really want to get an intergovernmental agreement, try to get more cooperation and do more of it ourselves?
Because that's working so well right now with the town of Normal.
What's always great to hear for folks is that on a staff level, we on a daily basis, we share equipment, resources. We were always thankful for our local partners, McLean County and Normal and others, even into the townships. We've got some great people in this area.
We're talking with City of Bloomington Public Works Director Jim Karch, and he is proposing the City of Bloomington spend $8 million a year for the next decade to make up for many years of a lack of spending or spending enough to improve city streets. I'm Colleen Reynolds.
Tomorrow on Sound Ideas, GLT's Colleen Reynolds has more about a unique proposal to help address the street repair deficit. You're listening to Sound Ideas and Pokey LaFarge.
The Missouri is my right arm, the Ohio is my left.
It's Central Time by Pokey LaFarge, one of Bloomington Normal's favorite sons, currently making waves on the American music scene. LaFarge is a former GLT summer concert headliner and a U-High graduate. He'll perform on Conan O'Brien this evening on TBS, and he'll be joined by another Bloomington Normal native, saxophonist Ryan Weisite. Acousticity host Bruce Bergethon talked with LaFarge in 2015. He had just released his first album on Rounder Records.
The Missouri is my right arm, the Ohio is my left. But I'm living on the Mississippi River where I like life the best. I don't mind the West Coast, and I don't mind the East Coast. Oh, baby, but I ain't gonna live on no coast. I'm just a plain old Midwestern boy. Yes, I'm getting by on Central Time.
Nowadays based in St. Louis, Pokey is an unapologetic spokesperson for the American heartland.
The pride in where I come from has probably only been reinforced even more with all of the traveling that I've done since I left home. I think Midwestern folks are more often than not pretty humble people. There's not really a whole lot of like Midwestern pride like there is Southern pride or New York City pride or LA or whatever. But you know, I catch a lot of flack for that too. People will sort of pigeonhole me in that way. They want to like use that as some like if it's a limitation that I feel that way. You gotta piss off some people, man. You know, I love a little bit of haters every once in a while. You know, I'll even serve them a nice big cold glass of Haterade if they like it. You know, it's inspirational, it's motivational.
I won't worry if the world don't like me. I won't let them waste my time. There ain't nothing gonna change my mind. I'm feeling fine because the Missouri is my.
I'm Bruce Bergethon talking with Pokey LaFarge. I don't know if you've come across this. A local editorialist, when listing things that Bloomington Normal should promote as being its own, this particular writer, who shall remain nameless, Steve Vogel, put you in the same category with Adlai Stevenson. And a great baseball player and a great writer. So
wow.
So we are proud of you, is what I'm saying. Adlai Stevenson, David Foster Wallace, who taught here at Illinois State University.
Yes,
Haas Radbourne, who was one of the early great
Haas Radbourne, yeah, man. He won. He has the most wins to this day, right? We looked it up. I think Haas Radbourne has like something like 60 wins, and I think he like pitched a complete game in every single game. Sorry, baseball guy, I got me sidetracked. Okay. I'm definitely, you know, still searching and really working hard to find a sound. I feel like on this latest record, I've gotten closer to this sound that I really want to get ever. Really pulling it back and developing a good groove. I mean, drums were essential to that, man.
She got a broke down El Camino in the front yard up on Broad. Her mom walks around in a pink nightgown, sandals and white socks. She don't mind a baseball game. in the middle of the lightning and the rain. She's a pain in my brain, drives me insane, but I love her just the same. Boys, love her just the same. Something in the water, something in the water.
I'm led to understand that you are trying some things. I mean, you talk about the drums, but there's some, I don't know, do we call it more modern sensibility or more pop music sensibility underlying some of these songs? Is that, how would you characterize it?
That's a good question. That's kind of a good way to start with it, talking about this new record. Well, the producer of this record, Jimmy Sutton, and I definitely have a foundation in older music for sure. And we'll never shed that. That's where we come from. But the key thing for us going forward was juxtaposing perhaps my foundation music, if you will, with something that maybe somebody else doesn't expect, but ultimately to create a feeling and to make the best song that you can and not worry about the categorization. What are people going to think? What is this going to sound? Is this going to sound too modern? Is this going to sound too old? It's just whatever feels good, what sounds right. You know, we wanted to start with a good groove. We wanted to have really, you know, great background singing and great musicianship, but we have a lot of space.
Bloomington Normal musician Pokey LaFarge with Bruce Burgathon from a 2015 interview. LaFarge's career continues to rise tonight playing The Conan O'Brien Show on TBS. You can hear LaFarge's music on Acousticity Sunday nights on GLT, and you can hear Acousticity 24/7 at WGLT.org. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and individual stories and interviews. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media, 89.1 GLT, WGLT Normal, and WGLT.org.